directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy. Previously broadcast program.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihera Zazan. When the Palestinian Nakba, or the catastrophe of 1948, is discussed, it's commonly understood to refer to the destruction of villages and the displacement of about 700,000 Palestinians. What gets left out is what happened to the people who remained in the borders of what became Israel and the transformations the new state created on the land, natural resources, the public space, and urban development. This week, Mira Nabulsi continues her conversation with Palestinian architect and urban planner Lama Shahadeh about Israel's settler colonial project and how it manifests itself in urban planning within the 1948 territories and how it impacted Palestinian citizens of Israel.
This whole idea of Israel made the desert bloom, which became perhaps also normalized internationally. I wanted us to talk a little bit about the cost of what that meant for the water sources. And I wanted us to kind of understand a little bit, how did Palestinians use these water sources before? And what happened to them once Israel got into this whole project of turning the Negev desert, one of its early projects, to
First, Palestinians, like all other people then, we used water locally. We lived based on natural resources. That's how human beings basically moved along this planet. They looked for resources, they lived near them, and they used them. But what Israel did as a colonial system is that they don't care where the resources are. They see everything from above. So for them, this amount of water in Palestine, it doesn't matter where, they can use technology or whatever infrastructure, they can get enough money to build huge infrastructure and to transfer the water from wherever they want. And that's how they saw this. They see it as a very modern, developed technology that they teach it to the world. They teach it as a very successful thing that they did, that they transferred water from the rich north to the desert. First of all, they had the new law, the water law, that removed all private or collective property rights over water resources. And they said water resources that are like springs, streams, river, lakes, whatever, underground or above ground water, is now all under the ownership of the state. And they had new government companies that control it and allocate the water resources, etc. And they built the national water carrier from the Jordanian River to the desert. And the Jordanian River is shared by Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, and Jordan too. But no one cares. Israel is just took the water from the Tiberias lake that they occupied, and they transformed the water to the desert. And to do that, they built a dam at the southern part of the lake, and they prevented the Jordanian River to continue to the Dead Sea. And now the Dead Sea is 35% of its area is dry, and it's artificial now. So that's one basically cost of that project, that we lost the only place on earth, the Dead Sea. There's nothing like this in any other place but Palestine. So we lost it. And also we got dry rivers, dry streams. The main rivers at the center or the north, they got only 5% of their original flow or 2% of their original flow. It was a drought, basically, all over Palestine. And now they realized that they exploited natural resources, not just because they transferred water from north to south, but because of this rapid urbanization of the whole place. When we say that they doubled the population, it's not a natural process. is just bringing too many people and building industrial zones and making them live in a very modern lifestyle too. But also, even if they didn't live the modern lifestyle, the other lifestyle, like the agriculture, they didn't see agriculture as part of working the land. They saw it as a capitalist workshop too. The Jewish agriculture project that they're very proud of, and they talk about it, they teach about it again to people around the world. They bring people from all over the world to help them in agricultural cities and settlements as a national icon for Israelis. Those agricultural lands consumed 90% of water resources in Palestine. And that got us to the fact that we don't have water anymore. And now Israel is treating seawater and treating saline underground water. So we don't drink natural water anymore. Now, I think more than 60% of agricultural lands are getting recycled water. And 80% of household consumption is seawater treated water and not natural water resources, which is again relying on technology and chemicals in order to live after exploiting the water resources and making this natural transformation of the area. Now we're again living under a place where we rely on electricity in order to drink. And when they took over the water resources, they also demolished many of the water facilities, like local, it's not facilities, like local pools that were in every village for animals to drink or for people to wash their clothes, whatever. They demolished those places. They also closed all the springs because villages were built around springs. Mm-hmm. So they closed the springs and that's it. You're not allowed to take water anymore. And the only water that you can drink or use is whatever flows to your house, and then it's allocated by the government companies. The national water carrier, it doesn't work anymore because they don't have enough water. What they do is that they transfer water from the sea to the center. So it's like going now from west to east instead of north to south.
So did they abandon this whole idea about continuing to make the Negev Desert green? How can they continue with that project? Because if they...
They didn't stop that project. There is enough treated water for that project. The main thing is always the Zionist project. Whatever they need for that, they will find a solution for it. It's very sad what's happening in the desert. They also planted forests to claim land so the desert will become green. They have large areas of agricultural lands too. So if you go to Google Maps, you go to satellite image, see the border with Gaza, and you'll be shocked. Like, what is this? Like, one agricultural land is the same area as a Palestinian camp in Gaza, but it's all one color because it's owned by one maybe person that is benefiting from the profit of this land. Now, instead of encouraging people to go to the desert for agriculture or for the national goals, now they're trying to encourage them by high-tech parks, high-tech cities. They're building new cities for people who work for those big high-tech companies, and they're encouraging them to go to the desert. They can subsidize many projects and encourage investors to build there. They're still building. And what's happening to Palestinians there is a sad story of our Nakba that's still ongoing, because there are Palestinian Bedouins living there, and there are tens of dozens of villages that are still unrecognized. When I say unrecognized village, it means that Israel doesn't see it as a legal place, but their historic village, they lived there. But again, as I say, the Ottoman law was different than the British laws, and then they don't recognize the paperwork that those people have. For the Israelis, those people don't own the land, and they have to move. And they built seven new, well, not new anymore, but seven cities to concentrate the Bedouins, to prevent them from living all over the desert, mm-hmm. although they don't really live all over the desert but anymore, because they forced them to move and they expelled them from all over the place. But they want to concentrate them even more. And they demolished already many, many villages, and they continue to do that. And those unrecognized villages don't have water system, don't have electricity, they don't have nothing, and they're under the threat of being demolished. What they want is basically to make those people move to the new cities. And those new cities are awful. So they use the tribal system that the Bedouin community is known as, and then they give like every tribe a neighborhood. Imagine like Bedouin people moving from living within the desert, working the land.
Nomadic.
Well, not very nomadic, but at least connected to nature. But then they force them into like this small parcels where each family has one parcel. You'll see very high percentage of crime rates, poverty. Those places are awful. So no one wants also to move to those models, to those new cities. Even if they're good, people have the right not to move there, because they have the right to live at their historic villages. This is their land. But even if, let's say, people want to give up on their land, the solutions are awful. People cannot live under those conditions.
It's very clear that the approach, and you definitely alluded to that a lot, which is the approach that Israel has historically used, is very similar to European colonialism when working with nature. So instead of nature being, you know, similar to how indigenous communities lived here and different parts of the world, much more in unity and in tandem with nature, we're talking about an approach that is basically commodifying water and natural resources, and has a different idea of nature that is much more based off control and making money. And that speaks to so much of, I think, what you were saying. I want us to move to talk a little bit about basically the differences in urban planning between Jewish towns and Palestinian towns. And I'm thinking zoning, plans, maps, construction and development. And how does it differ between Jewish Israeli urban centers and Palestinian?
When we talk about Jewish urban planning, we're talking about planning from zero on empty lands. So it's very easy, very central, very Western. It's like you have this engineer or urban planner that comes and draw the neighborhoods, decide what will be where, the streets network, whatever, and it's all public owned. So it's very easy later to control who live where and how to allocate all those resources within the cities. But then if we compare this to the planning system that works, the same planning system, by the way, it's the same law. We're still under the Israeli law, but then it's a law that came from above and was forced on us. It works differently then, because we live on our private owned land, which means like my family owns this one dunam of land. We have our house, our grandfather's house, whatever, in one very particular square. And then for the Israelis, they know that, okay, if you want to build a house, you have to get a permit to build the house. And to get a permit to build a house, it means that there should be a master plan for that area. To have a master plan for that area means that someone has to come and draw the map and plan it, do like the zoning thing. Where's the industrial zone? Where's the residential zone? What's allowed here, there? Where's the street, the network, etc.? But they did not do that until after 2000, which means that we lived for decades in unplanned places. Unplanned places means that it's okay to live in an unplanned place. I'm not saying that planning is the best way, but if you live freely in that unplanned place, at least you can have your own system or your own whatever communal system of allocating land, of real estate system, of a way to build houses, etc. But we lived in those closed borders where we cannot expand them. The only thing that we could do was to build our private houses on top of our parents' house or on our agricultural land that we don't need it anymore because it's not profit anymore. And we have to have a house, so that's a priority now. So people transferred those agricultural lands into houses, and the next generation built another layer of houses. So those areas became very dense. And now if you come to those places and try to do the master plan, it's ridiculous, because where you can have a street, where can you decide on an industrial zone? Like, how can you do an industrial zone or plan a zone in a place that is all built already? And the facilities that are not residential are mixed within those residential areas. You'll see people's businesses under their houses, which is the only way for them to open the business. It has to be in their house. But then mixed-use planning is a good thing, but it's good when you have good infrastructure for it, but not when it's in a very narrow streets and those old cities, old villages where you can't even park your car. And add to this the amount of cars that now we need that made all this place very, very hard to live in. We don't have public transportation because the regulations for bus lines cannot work on those villages. You don't have enough space in the street. You can't build the station, the bus stops, etc. Until very, very recently, 99% of the Palestinian villages did not have bus lines, which means that you cannot even go to your work. So you have to have a car, which made many, many women unemployed. We have the highest percentage of unemployed women compared to all Palestinians living in Gaza or West Bank even. And high rate of poverty too, because in those villages, when you don't expand the border, it's not because we want to live in undense places, but we want resources. When you expand borders and, you know, build industrial zones, build schools, all those facilities that you need, you also get profit from this. You have places to work, you have schools to go to, you have parks, you have sports facilities, etc. Our villages lack all those facilities. It became only residential villages with time, which means that the whole lifestyle is not traditional too, because we're in 2021, but it's not modern also. So if you want to go out with your friends, you don't have where to go. So you have to go to like someone's house or whatever. And imagine this with the traditional family conservative lifestyle. You cannot leave that lifestyle. You cannot change it or work towards a better community because you're stuck there. The only way where to live is to live within your family household still, or in the same unit or above your parents or whatever. And all family relatives live approximately around each other. So it enforced this lifestyle. Our other main problem that's other than the housing problem and the planning problem is the crime rate, because Israel is not interested and they distribute guns. So whatever guns people can get, they're getting from police, from army. So yeah, we have criminal families, we have high crime rate, all within those very dense neighborhoods or cities.
And you're saying a lot of the guns that end up in the hands of Palestinian communities, how does that work exactly? How do they end up in people's hands?
Yeah, both from policemen and from army. We don't control borders. We don't have any way to get guns from anywhere. And Israel is not interested in enforcing any law that prevent people from having their guns. So it's illegal. It's illegal. It's not like the US. It is illegal, but Israel doesn't enforce the law for decades now. And after decades of not enforcing such an important law, you know, people will just protect themselves because of the chaos that started happening. And yeah, it is from police and army, and it is known how it's transferred to us, how the policemen, you know, sell them. It's a black market of guns. So that's the image kind of how stuck those villages are in terms of planning and developing industrial areas, education facilities, public facilities, etc. But then what is happening is that it's hard to live there. And when it's hard to live there, we're studying, we're seeing that, oh, we should live in a better place. And we try to go to the cities, and the cities are kind of closed borders for us. The Jewish cities, they don't have space for us, not schools, racism, etc. So it's very hard to live in those Jewish cities or committees that legally prevent us from buying houses. So we go to the historic villages like Haifa or Yaffa or those areas where there were historic Palestinian community, and today it's like mixed cities, and we live there. We live also in like those development towns too, in the mm-hmm. north, or because it's cheaper sometimes to buy a house there. It's a town, it's not, they don't have committees, but still, if you live there, it's very hard to commute to your school, but still, there are no other options. And those development towns, they were built on our lands, that was the goal, yeah. So they're very close to us. Which worked. Now it's funny, like, yeah, they built it in order to make the Galilee Jewish, But then, suddenly we have kind of towns near us where we can commute and live. Not everyone can do that, but some people can. Or we go to Haifa or those historic urban centers, and that's like the only way to live an urbanized life outside of those villages.
So I wanted us to talk about the mixed cities. First, let's explain a little bit what mixed city means.
Well, that's actually not a good term to use, but that's how we call them usually, mixed cities. It's an occupied city that used to be a Palestinian city, but then because it's a city, it was easier for Jewish people during the British mandate to live there. And later on in 1948, we were expelled. Some of their neighborhoods were demolished and it became a Jewish-only city with a Palestinian neighborhood. So let's talk, for example, about Haifa and Yaffa, Akka. Those are the cities that I'm talking about. So what happened, for example, in Haifa is that it used to be, it's a Palestinian city. It was built like 3,000 years ago. What happened during the British mandate is that it was a very important city because of the port and so on. So it was a growing city and many Jewish people lived there. They were coming from Europe. It's a good target where they can live and grow economically. They built new neighborhoods for Jewish people to move freely. And after that, in 1948, those cities were, you know, during the Nakba, the Palestinian neighborhoods were demolished. People were expelled. So Haifa, for example, I think from 70,000 Palestinians that lived in Haifa, only 3,000 remained. And they were forced to move into one neighborhood, that is Wadi Nisnas. It became like a ghetto. So whoever remained in Haifa and was not expelled lived in one particular neighborhood. And people that were expelled from cities, because it was on the shoreline, like on the sea, so they were expelled by boats. They're not internally displaced. They didn't move to Palestinian villages, they moved outside to Lebanon or other places. So we lost also the urban community. We lost those group of people, and who remained were basically mostly people of the villages. That's another transformation of the Palestinian community. Coming back to those people, to the Palestinian who remained, they were forced into one neighborhood. Wadi Nisnas, for example, in Haifa, Ajami in Yaffa, the historic Akka, like the historic city in Akka, the old city. Whoever remained there, they, and also I talked about the property lots that transformed the ownership. So all the houses that are empty now, they were transformed to state ownership, controlled by governmental companies. And people who were forced to move to Wadi Nisnas, for example, they were forced to move not to their houses. They were forced to move to houses that is now owned by the government. So they became renters. Those houses are for Palestinians. So everyone will know who's this house for. Those ghetto neighborhoods became very poor until today. But then, because it's a city, it's urban life, and it was easier for Palestinians to move, and Haifa was in the north, for example, Akka too, where most of the Palestinians, around 60% of Palestinians that remained in historic Palestine lived in the north. So we were able, mostly during the 1990s, to rent houses there to start a new life in the city. So Haifa today, for example, is kind of the capital of Palestinians in Israel because of that situation. But then what is happening is that old neighborhoods, some of them were demolished, as I said. In Haifa, for example, they just demolished the old city that Taher al-Omar built, where people lived. They just demolished it and built new governmental offices and buildings. And
you're talking also about historical sites, like heritage sites, also were destroyed. Like the character of these cities that are thousands of years old was essentially altered. Very little is left of it.
Exactly. It was demolished, literally. So you don't see it. And when you go to some of the neighborhoods that remained or survived, you'll see some houses and you can kind of imagine how Haifa was before. So, for example, in Haifa, Wadi Nisnas is one example because it wasn't demolished. Another example is Wadi Salib that was not demolished, as I said, because Mizrahi Jews lived there. So they moved to Wadi Salib, and then until the government expelled them again from those houses, it was then hard to demolish because it was later in 1950s where Israel is now a state and the war ended. So they don't demolish anymore in the same way that they demolished during the Nakba. Then during the Nakba, when they decided that they want to demolish the old city, the planner, and I'm citing him now, he said that what he wanted is clearing the area for a new city was one way of replacing the hostile cityscape of the other, which means the Arab, with an appropriate environment for the new Jew. And this was Shaviv's planning a winning competition for the what is known now as the governmental offices in Haifa. And now what is happening to those places that remain, like Wadi Salib, for example, that is owned by the state because of the property thing, the absentees law, it's all by the state, but they're turning it into a neighborhood for artists, and they're encouraging people to rent studios, art spaces there, and now they're starting another residential project there, so it will become like the old city of Haifa. If you go to Yaffa, it's a very beautiful old city, and you will see it's empty. It's not the native people that living there. Who's living there are very rich Jewish, mostly artists. They build boutique hotels. It's like the image of gentrification that we know from all over the world, but the difference here is that it's very ethnic too.
Yeah, I definitely wanted us to unpack a little bit how a lot of the removal of Palestinians continues to this day in many of those historic cities, whether it's Akka, Acre, or Haifa. And definitely we see writings describing what's happening as gentrification, but perhaps that may neutralize a little bit the political and racial nature of what goes on.
Gentrification is correct in terms of maybe the process, but it makes it like the whole international idea of gentrification that's happening everywhere. It's not the same because in those areas, in those old cities, people don't own their houses. Some of them do, but many of them don't own their houses because of, as I said, they live in the state-owned houses. And then what happens is that those companies will decide that, oh, we have an investor that want to buy those houses for a lot of money, and they can sell it. And then what they say, okay, you as a renter, you can rent from them instead of renting from us as a state company. And then they will not become a protected renter anymore. Or other options too is that because of those places becoming like a hotspot, and investors are coming from all over the world to buy those houses, they're ready to pay those people enough money to leave. And when I say enough money, this money is not enough for them to buy another house in another place. It's a lot of money, but it's problematic too, because then the Palestinian environment that is known there will disappear. People cannot afford living in a place that is surrounded by boutique hotels. They cannot anymore have their small shop there. So many of them leave. And don't forget, like we're talking about poverty neighborhoods where many other social problems happening there, like crime, the old city of Akka, they encourage people to leave. Also, for example, the Israelis are building a new Arab town. That's how they call it. It's called Tantura. That's the only place that was planned. It's not happening yet, but that was planned for Arabs since 1948. Nothing was built, no expansion, no new cities, nothing, but the concentration cities of Bedouin. That's not counted. But no new city was built for us. And now they're deciding, oh, we want to build a new Arab town in the Galilee area, very close to Akka. It's a very bad plan. It's a very dense, unfair on the lands of Arab Palestinians living in the next village, but their lands were expropriated during the 1970s. But instead of giving them the land back, they're building a new city there. One of the goals of this city is basically to absorb people leaving Akka. We may see within, I don't know, a decade or so that people are actually leaving Akka.
And that's Loma Shahadeh speaking with Mira Nabulsi about Israel's settler colonial project and how it manifests itself in urban planning within the 1948 territories and how it has impacted Palestinian citizens of Israel. We are in a fundraising period, and I'm asking you to support KPFA and this program, Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, by calling 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We depend only on your financial support to be able to operate this station and pay our bills. If you have been listening but have not contributed yet, This is the day to do it. Please go to your phones, dial 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We much prefer to get the donation through KPFA's website at kpfa.org. In this mini fund drive, we are offering the Storytelling for Social Change, an audio pack which includes speeches from jazz greats Herbie Hancock, guitar legend Carlos Santana, co-founder of Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale, and much more. Make a pledge at any amount and you will receive an email with a link to these special recordings. You may never have the opportunity to access these special events, so please donate today and get KPFA's Storytelling for Social Change now at kpfa.org or 1-800-439-5732. Please give us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or at kpfa.org. Now let's hear more of Mira's interview with Lama Shahadeh, and please keep donating to KPFA by going to kpfa.org and show your support for this program and other shows on this radio station, 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Thank you.
I wanted to understand if there's a role for settler organizations in these areas that get emptied of Palestinian population. Is there any similarity that can be drawn or comparison that we can see between how we see settlement expansion in the West Bank, for example, or forced evictions and home demolitions in Jerusalem, and what happens inside communities of Palestinians inside Israel?
There are a group of settlers, like those people who are working in Sheikh Jarrah, for example, bringing people to live between Palestinians in their house. There are similar groups working in Lid, Ramle. I don't know if you've heard about what happened in Lid, for example, at the last month during the uprising. Those are settlers. Lid is one of those historic Palestinian cities. This is the same story like Haifa, Akka, Yafa, etc. The Palestinian community that remained there remained in a very particular area, and then the city became Jewish city, mostly Jewish. And there are those group and organizations that are encouraging settlers to come and buy houses and live in those neighborhoods in Lid. During May, the uprising, one young man was killed by a settler there. And then Jewish settlers were coming from all over the place by buses to Lid. And they were beating people in the street, calling like death for Arabs, breaking into houses, and they were protected by the police. Even the police was helping them. They also controlled the big mosque. It's called the big mosque, throwing bombs into the mosque. All those that we call mixed cities, occupied cities, in all those cities, clashes happened on a daily basis during May. Because in those places, Palestinians live in those ghettos and poor neighborhoods. And then settlers and Israelis live very next to them, very close to them. And the Palestinians are minority, so it's easier to attack them. It's easier than going into a Palestinian village in the Galilee or in the Naqab, in the desert. So they broke into houses, into neighborhoods. They organized buses in all those cities, in Haifa, in Yafa, Akka. In Akka, the police just closed the old city and prevented the Palestinians from leaving the old city, and then left the Jewish settlers going by bus to another Arab neighborhood that's outside the old city. They broke into houses, they were breaking cars, trying to fire houses. It was a big clash between police and those Zionist Jewish settlers and Palestinians living in those mixed cities. And that was the image in all those cities. So yeah, talking about groups of or organization, yeah, they are very organized. they organized themselves very well. We saw them working like an army during May. And this is how they work when they sell houses, when they see a neighborhood as a real estate opportunity and decide, oh, here we go, we will buy those houses and then we will encourage people to rent them or whatever. They work as an organization in many places.
So is there like a coordination between maybe these development companies that own now lots of land perhaps or areas and settler organizations? Because it's often in the West, I feel like settler groups or Jewish settlers are portrayed as this fringe right-wing community. It almost feels like they're just an embarrassment to Israel. They just would do their own thing. I think what's missing from the picture is how much of that is actually coordinated and state-sanctioned, really.
That's the way that Israel tries to work. It's like those settlers are not the state. Those are individuals or groups of people. And that's true, but it is a state job. It is a state work because, first of all, to work this way, it means that your laws and your system works for them. Let me find an example to explain that. Let's say this Jewish National Fund thing that now is under the Israeli law, it's only for Jewish people. They're not allowed to sell those lands or areas to Palestinians, for example. Mm-hmm. So using this law, for example, allows a Jewish city, let's say in the north, in the desert, wherever, in the center, to expand for a new Orthodox community neighborhood. There is a need. Well, there is a need for everyone, but there is a need for example, for those Orthodox Jewish groups for housing, and they can use this state-owned land for them. It might be seen as a normal thing. It's like a state, yeah, finding solution for its citizen. But on the other hand, when you see that the same state is preventing other people from living in this land, then you'll see that someone is living on the expense of other people. Same with the West Bank. They let them settle on lands that are not privately owned by Palestinians, let's say. Oh, that's if Palestinians can claim that they own this land in the West Bank. Also, this settlement is illegal for Israelis. But if they're settling on a land that it's public land, which should be owned by Palestinian Authority, the PA, but it's Area C, that's controlled by Israelis. So for them, oh, it's a public land, so it's a state land, it's Israel's land. And they treat it the same way that they treat the 93% in historic Palestine. It treated as their own land. So a settlement is legal there then. They don't enforce them to leave. They don't make those new settlers leave the area. But not just they don't make them leave, they build infrastructure to connect them to the cities or to the historic Palestine.
That's one of the interesting things is how we see on one hand Palestinians confined and separated, whereas with the Jewish Israelis, even if they live in the West Bank, there's always a way to kind of ensure the integrity, territorial integrity, and as well the connection between communities. That's obviously not afforded even to Palestinians who happen to carry the Israeli citizenship.
Yeah. It's not about the settlement itself for those 100 people that is, you know, taking over this specific land in the West Bank, but it's about the whole thing, the whole infrastructure, the whole natural resources around them. They fight over the water there. Who's doing the job for Israel? Basically, the settlers there. And the army is just protecting the settlers as a third party. They sometimes make it seen as, oh, it's not our, we didn't do that as Israelis, as army. The settlers did this clash with this village. They took the water and we're just protecting them from killing each other. And that's very similar to what happened in 1948 too. They used all those group of people that took over land, that built some of the agricultural settlements. They called them pioneers. Today, they call Israelis that settled in Palestine during the British Mandate as pioneers. They don't call the settlers of the West Bank as such. At least those group, they call themselves the leftist Israelis. They don't call the settlers in the West Bank as pioneers, but they call themselves, their grandfathers, as pioneers. But they're the same system. They're doing the same work.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that argument is used by the right-wing Israelis. It's used by the settlers when they're arguing with leftist Jewish. They're saying, mm-hmm. you did the same thing in 1948. Why you want us to leave the West Bank, but you're not leaving Jaffa?
They're the pioneers of the West Bank.
Yeah, exactly. And it's ridiculous because it's true. I heard this argument talking to the owner of Haaretz, the newspaper that is it's called the leftist newspaper, but then its facilities, its offices are built on Yaffa's historic orange farms. One of the people said, why you don't also give those lands back to Palestinians who were expelled? Because the same thing is happening in the West Bank. Why this is legal and this is illegal?
Emma, I wanted us to close with hopefully some positive thoughts as well. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the situation is pretty grim. We're talking about control, removal, and all sorts of violence, really, and very difficult conditions and poverty, as you had mentioned. In light of all of this ethnic cleansing that we see mm-hmm. continued as well inside of Israel, we saw the latest uprising that you mm-hmm. talked about a little bit. Briefly, just give us an idea about the organizing going on. And I wanted also some personal thoughts from you as an architect and as an urban planner. What vision do you have for your community?
If you asked me this question like 2 months ago before this uprising, I would be less optimistic. But this uprising was like an eyes-opening again event. The good thing about it, the main thing as I see it, is that it unified Palestinians all over historic Palestine. Because when I want to think about Palestine as a place that we deserve justice, we dream of a better future, we want redistribution of the resources, we want to live equal with everyone and without borders, etc. I don't see solutions on individual scale or local scales. I don't think that our struggle is to make this village in historic Palestine get a new industrial zone or a new residential area and be connected to the center or to Tel Aviv so people can go to work. I don't see our struggle as such. This is not a solution. It's just making one class of people benefit from something so they stop struggling for people who are facing poverty and crime and etc. If I want to see a solution in Palestine, it should be first for all Palestinians in the same way. It means that we all share the same political status, we share the same space, we share our environment, our Palestine in the same way all over Palestine. So this uprising basically reminded us of this very basic human right to be connected again to your people, to work together, to see each other, to live the same life. It was a very encouraging event. And what happened also is that it reminded us all that it's one colonial system, which is very important because you see how what's happening in the West Bank. They also have another controlling system that works to prevent people from their struggle. They have the issues of PA and Israel and all those agreements between them, all this, and we saw people fighting in the streets now. So it's one connected event, seeing historic Palestine as one thing and we're working together for liberation. That's what this uprising did. And in terms of talking about maybe planning or whatever vision for people, I see those two scales. One scale is this very big uprising that talks about historic Palestine as one thing. Then the community level organizations that we should work on. Because in this uprising, people were afraid. People wanted to save their places to prevent people from breaking into their houses. So they were getting organized in all those villages and neighborhoods. We did so many campaigns, so many small organizations, basically didn't wait for any political leadership, for any parties, for any of this traditional way of organizing that we knew in Palestine. And we got another level of community organization that was amazing and it's a model to learn from. And that's how I think we can continue in seeing our future struggle, because we want, again, organizations that speak to workers, that speak to women, that speak to neighborhood scale, and not just one big party that doesn't work with people in the street. If you feel this is your neighborhood, this is your place, this area is yours and you belong to it and you're organized with people, you can treat it better. You belong to it. So you even care more about the public space. You care more about facilities that you need, and you're not stuck into your own mind trying to just find a solution for yourself. Achieving things, especially in planning and in housing solution and stuff, you may achieve something. For solutions, you need political struggle. We don't want to cope with this colonial system. We don't want to be able just to build a house and get water infrastructure and that's it. We don't want to cope with this. We want to get rid of this colonial system. And to get rid of the system, we have to look at the big image. We have to see Palestinians as one nation. We have to see our struggle as one struggle in order to fight the colonial system and not just work within the lines that they draw for us.
And that was Lama Shahade speaking with Mira Nabulsi about Israel's settler colonial project and how it manifests itself in urban planning within the 1948 territories and how it has impacted Palestinian citizens of Israel. I am Maliha Razazan, and you are listening to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa on KPFA in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. And I'm joined via Zoom by my colleague Khalil Bendib. Hi, Khalil.
Good morning, Maliha.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
They're still working remotely.
Yes.
And we're doing this because we are in the midst of our summer mini fund drive, and we are trying to raise money, much needed money, for KPFA. As usual, we only depend on your financial support to be able to operate this station and pay our bills. If you have been listening to us but have not contributed yet, please do so today. Go to your phones, dial 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or it is much easier for us if you can donate online through KPFA's website at kpfa.org. That's kpfa.org. And Khalil, the theme of this membership drive is the storytelling for social change. And that's really what we did today. We have been hearing an in-depth conversation about the history of urban development, the stealing of water resources, destruction of local agriculture and public spaces by Israel since 1948, and how Palestinians in recent months have come together fighting for structural change, fighting against the settler colonial project that's called Israel. And in the Storytelling for Social Change audio pack, which we offer, there are speeches from jazz great Herbie Hancock, guitar legend Carlos Santana, one of your favorites, Khalil,
yes,
co-founder of the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale, and much more. KPFA's thank you gift for all donors at any level comes in your confirmation email when you donate to KPFA. Make a pledge of any amount and you will receive an email with the link to these special recordings. No download codes, no jumping through hoops, just click the link and drive right in. You may never have the opportunity to access these special events again. So please donate today and get KPFA's Storytelling for Social Change now at kpfa.org or 1-800-439-5732.
Khalil? Yes, so we've seen this colonial project going on for ever since 1948. It started before, but actually became Israel in 1948. And it shows no signs of letting up. There's this incredibly hot war, cold and hot. The Israelis have been encouraged and empowered by Trump, who stopped pretending, unlike his predecessors, that there was any daylight between U.S. policy and Israeli demands. But even past the Trump administration, now in the Biden administration, hardly any change The Jerusalem embassy is staying there. The U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem is staying. Hardly any changes have come. Just a change, a slight change in the tone. It's a more moderate tone. But the Zionists have been empowered by this incredible unconditional support that never lets up, regardless of what happens. The Jewish community, thankfully, is now deeply divided in this country. More and more so. There's more and more support for BDS within the Jewish community, more and more support for Palestinian rights. Thankfully, it took, 80 years to get to this point. But finally, we're seeing a deeply, deeply divided Jewish community in terms of their support for Israel, which is progress. We see unions, teacher unions in New York. CUNY is up in arms over BDS. We see it in Los Angeles, the teachers' union. We see it here in San Francisco. The teachers' unions have courageously taken stands in favor of Palestinian right, which used to be like a form of science fiction. You never expected these things to happen. And among the leadership, strongly and prominently, are Jewish names and Jewish minds who are passionately voicing their support for Palestinian rights. So it seems that this fight, this struggle, is getting even more passionate than before, because on both sides, things are getting even more increasingly heated. You have people, activists, who are not letting up on liberating Palestine. On the other side, you have people who are, take Ben and Jerry's recently.
I know.
Ben and Jerry's have come under fire for doing not much, from my point of view. They're saying not Israel, but in the occupied territories, they're not going to sell ice cream anymore. I mean, can you imagine how moderate, how mealy-mouthed even this stand is, and yet it's coming under incredible fire from the other side that's saying, no way you're going to stop selling ice cream in the occupied territories. So it's an amazing thing to watch. This struggle is not letting up.
And also this interview really shows how interconnected the struggles are. The struggle against gentrification, land theft, water resources. This is something that we're seeing here. We have been seeing here in the United States, especially by indigenous communities against North Dakota Access Pipeline. We can see the connections of these struggles. The same thing is happening in Iran, Khalil, right now, that there have been week-long protests against water shortage in Khuzestan. And several people have been killed, scores have been injured due to corruption, mismanagement, climate crisis, and we will do a show about this next week. So we see how these struggles are really connected, and I think this is where KPFA comes in. We have the time, we have an hour or even more, because you just heard the second part of this interview. It's a long interview. We have the luxury of spending as much time as we need to really peel the layers of complex issues that we are dealing with, or historical issues such as the colonization of Palestine in 1948 and the issue of water, climate crisis, corruption, endemic corruption in Iran. So if you support this program and if you support KPFA that allows us to bring different voices on our show, please give us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or go to kpfa.org. Please consider becoming a sustaining member of KPFA Radio by agreeing to donate a recurring payment of at least $10 a month. Not only will you provide KPFA with a predictable and dependable source of income, which will lower our costs and allow us to fund programming and member services, but it just may let us shorten our pledge drives in general, which I think is a plus. Monthly recurring donations are the easiest and most convenient way for you to give to KPFA and ensure that our programs receive your support while also letting you set an affordable amount that works within your budget. Choose the monthly donation option when you donate at kpfa.org. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And Khalil, KPFA is so, so crucial. I have been following the events in Iran and the protests. There have been workers' protests, strikes. We did a show about that a couple of weeks ago. And this mass protest against water shortage is getting scant or really very convoluted coverage. And I think we are here to correct the narrative. And if you support this, please do join us by calling 1-800-439-5732 or go to kpfa.org.
As you were saying, Melihe, all these struggles are connected. They're one and the same struggle. On one side, you have basically might makes right philosophy of the world. And on the other side, you have human rights. And the two are not compatible. What we're seeing is a continuation of the colonial past into today, into the present, and people are trying to push it into the future. While at the same time, things are getting more progressive. You know, we have more and more politicians, younger people, who are coming to the fore and saying, no, there's no reason to continue the racism and the hatred and the division. And so it's an epic struggle, and we're witnessing it as it happens.
And you know, Khalil, people are getting really tired and getting bolder and bolder. And we see that in Iran. And we have seen, as Lama says in the interview, people were losing hope in Palestine of what was going on. But these recent protests and organizing, they really have inspired a lot of people to think collectively about what needs to change. And not just cosmetic changes, a building here, a permit there, but really trying to change everything from the bottom up. And as I said, fundamentally and structurally. And I think we see that in Palestine, we see that in Iran, we see that with indigenous movements in Latin America, here, protests in Colombia, in Brazil. The whole world is on fire. And I think it's our responsibility as journalists to amplify these voices and to let people know what is happening in other parts of the world and about these struggles and why it matters and why our faith, our future, it's all connected, especially because of the climate crisis that sees no boundaries. It has hit everywhere. More than 200 cities in Iran are suffering from water shortage. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. And we see the relationship between colonialism and water resources in Palestine. So if you really value this this kind of coverage and conversations, I think it's part of our duty, really, to support KPFA and support independent media. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. I mean, we live in a very, very difficult time with COVID and, again, the spikes that we're seeing across the country and unemployment, and people are hurting financially and otherwise. But if you are able to support and donate 10, 20, 100, 200, please do so. And if you can't, we really appreciate you being one of our listeners. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We have a couple of more minutes left. Khalil, any final thoughts?
Were it not for KPFA here in the Bay Area and Pacifica nationwide, the prospects would be even darker, would be gloomy, would be desperate. We do have this voice, we have this lung to breathe and allows us to hope. So let's keep it going. Let our listeners be part of this beautiful movement. And please come and contribute whatever you can and keep on listening and keep on telling others to listen. It's the right thing to do.
1-800-439-5732. 90.3 FM. Montreal.
With the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Sarah Patties is on a fast break with Veggie Patty leading the charge. The pass is down deep to Goat Patty. Goat Patty passes baseline to Beef Patty. Beef Patty shoots from downtown at the buzzer. And bingo! It's in! It's in! Carob Patties wins the game and is now the world champions! The number one in Montreal. Come on down to 9550 Jean Milot in LaSalle for the best patties, roadies, jerk chicken, and more. Or call us at 438-387-4004. Carob Patties, the champions of Montreal.
Two, one, two. You hear it? Yo, yo.